Welcome back to the program. Human resilience and the instinct for survival is an amazing thing. The question has always been, is this something inherent only in certain individuals, or can others learn the skills and abilities needed to pull oneself out of difficult and in some cases impossible circumstances? Our guest today, Carissa Phelps, has herself as a child survived the horrors of the mean streets while now working even harder to help others rise above their circumstances. At the age of 12, Carissa was thrust into the streets of Fresno, and today, with a law degree and an MBA from UCLA and a career in private equity that she walked away from, she is a model of what it means to be a survivor. Carissa Phelps is the author of a new book about her experiences entitled Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. It is my pleasure to welcome Carissa Phelps to the program today. Carissa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you here. You were 12 years old. You wound up on the streets. What happened?
Well, I ended up being very vulnerable and needing to take care of myself, not being able to get a job at 12 years old. I would take care of people's kids and sometimes their households, but eventually would be sucked into being sexually exploited and then commercially trafficked as a child for other people's benefit.
How did you wind up on the streets at 12?
Well, I had a large family and 10 brothers and sisters, pretty chaotic household, the opposite of Brady Bunch. We did have my six brothers and sisters from my real father, four young children that my stepfather had, and he was a widower, and then another child that my mom and stepfather had. And I was kind of lost in the mix of all of that. And my mom herself, she was a young teen mom when she started herself. She was abandoned, and my stepdad was erratic with his behavior, very angry, had anger issues, abusive in multiple ways, and I was trying to escape all of that and try to search for a better life and didn't realize that at 12 years old, that would make me very vulnerable.
Talk about what it was like being out there on the streets, being vulnerable at 12 years old. What did you think would happen?
Well, some of it was a rush. Some of it was, you know, being able to be away and be on my own and make my own decisions for my life. Some of it was really empowering in a way. And then what would happen is I still needed things, basic needs like clothing, shelter, love, affection. And those were taken advantage of by men, at first men that I thought were my boyfriends, even though they were in their 20s. I thought, well, this guy really likes me, and I'm 12 and he's 24, but maybe something can happen when I'm 16 and I could really be his girlfriend. And I would just, you know, kind of go into these fantasies that maybe this person wasn't really using me. And eventually it ended up being older and older men who were trying to take advantage of me, and then finally a pimp trafficker who trapped me in a situation for about 10 days, and I was brutally raped. And I had heard stories before of other women on the streets who had had similar things happen to them, but I really still couldn't have seen it coming.
Were there other girls, other kids on the street that you were able to learn anything from at the time?
Well, a lot of kids, I couldn't, if they were on the street being sexually exploited, if they were on the street being turned out by a guy or something, usually you couldn't talk to them. You couldn't hang out with them, like they weren't your friends or buddies. My friends were usually from the group homes that I stayed in, and they had been exploited too, some of them by the same guys that I had been exploited by. But we didn't talk to adults about it, and we didn't get any help for it. We just kind of relied on each other.
Talk about those group homes and what services were and weren't available to you.
Well, group homes are, you know, even using the word home in them is just kind of misleading. It's a shelter, really. It's a place. It's a roof sometimes. But a lot of it is institutional in group homes. They follow a lot of rules and licensing and such that don't make sense to kids who are seeking that type of home environment and need love and need, you know, just a place to be sometimes as a kid, a place to be safe. It's not that type of environment at many, many group homes. They're usually understaffed or not very well-paid staff that are babysitting or really just housing kids and not raising them. if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about some of the facilities in addition to the group homes that you were in and out of over time.
Well, I was in and out of juvie a lot, and that was a result of me being caught for shoplifting. I was actually trying to head to the Bay Area. My sister had lived in the Bay Area, and she was trying to. She had sent me a Greyhound ticket and was trying to get me to come out with her, and I didn't have any clothes. I didn't have any shoes of my own. I didn't have any toiletries. I didn't have anything that belonged to me. And so I had kind of a partner that would help me shoplift, and her mom would even look out, watch out for us. And so we went to a Kmart, and we were shoplifting. Basically, I was packing a bag to go with my sister, and we got caught that time. And we both ended up going to juvenile hall. And the way the system works is, you know, it didn't make sense. There was no one there to say, why were you shoplifting? What did you need? What are your needs? How long have you been here alone? What's happened to you on the streets? Where were you heading? Nobody had those questions. Nobody tried to contact my sister and get her to come and get me. Instead, they just locked me up. My mom said she didn't want to come and get me, and so I spent 30 days in juvenile hall. And over time, then I would come in and out of juvenile hall for different violations of probation, running away, a big one, not going to school. And then before I was 13, a month before I was 13, I was kidnapped by this pimp and forced out on the streets and raped at gunpoint and had, you know, just been tortured. And I got away from that just barely, but by being arrested and taken into juvenile hall. And it made me slip into more crime. No one addressed the issue. The cop dropped me off at juvenile hall, didn't tell anybody where he picked me up or what the circumstances were. And I don't know if they just expect a 12-year-old to start talking about all that stuff, but they don't, and they won't. And I didn't. And I held it in for almost another year. And I got in worse and worse and worse crime and ended up with a 6-month sentence in juvenile hall for joyriding and receiving stolen property. And that's when I met a counselor, Ron Jenkins, who asked me what happened to you on the streets. He was the first person during almost 2 years of in and out of institutions and juvies that finally just asked me, what happened? Why are you here?
Well, did that surprise you even at the time, at 14 years old, the idea that nobody asked, nobody seemed to care?
I didn't know any better. I mean, I thought that's just how adults were, that kids didn't matter, really, that what they did when adults weren't looking or what was done to them didn't matter, at least to kids like us. Maybe to other kids it mattered, but not to kids like us, not to street kids. It just, we didn't matter.
Talk about Ron Jenkins and what he meant as a mentor to you.
He meant everything. He gave me an anchor. He gave me something to believe in, and it was inside of myself. It was, you know, that I had potential and that I could possibly be somewhere else. I didn't have to be in juvenile hall. I didn't have to be on a path to prison or death, that I could be looking for something else in my life. And he gave me that positivity that, you know, he had, the strength, that positive outlook on life. Despite growing up, he grew up in South Central, had grown up in foster care, had witnessed his brothers being, you know, murdered and suffering because of gangs and violence. And he grew up and he rose above it all, and he went on to college and was an amazing counselor, an amazing presence. And he shared that with me, and really in a lot of ways became a parent for me.
What was it in his message that resonated with you? Because I'm sure that there were lots of people that he counseled over the years that didn't respond in exactly the same way, but there was something that resonated with you.
Well, there were a couple things. One, that he was black, like just the fact that he was African-American male, and the pimp that had trafficked me was also an African-American male. And I thought to myself when I met Ron, I was young, but I thought to myself, okay, this guy is just positive. He sings when he walks around this facility. He smiles at us. He's nice to all the kids. All the kids he has a good reputation with. You know, if he tries to help me, if I refuse his help, am I being racist? Like, am I judging him in the wrong way because of bad things that were done to me? And I just really tried to overcome that and reach back to him when he reached out to me. It was, like, important for me to have that bond with him and to see him as the positive person that he was and that he was trying to be. And I didn't ever tell him that when I was a kid because I didn't know how to share that information. But it was really important to me, like, his culture, where he had come from, and that he was so positive.
Were you suspicious, though?
Not of Ron. That was the thing. It was, you know, there were a lot of people to be suspicious of, and a lot of people, I think, that take that job for the wrong reasons, for a paycheck, or because sometimes even because it's easier to abuse kids in those situations because they're kids without a voice. So, you know, there were people that I shouldn't have trusted in that institution, and I didn't trust. And then there were just people who were too busy or too distracted that couldn't take the time or didn't know really how to connect. And all of those things kept me distant, I think, maybe from other counselors. But with Ron, I really didn't have any reason not to trust him.
How did you begin to move from the inspiration that you got from Ron Jenkins to beginning to turn your life around?
Well, it was a math teacher in juvenile hall. It's kind of like everything was set up, and I really believe that was the divine nature of all of this. Like, there was definitely a higher power playing this out for us and putting us all in the right place. And the amazing thing is that years later, you know, 16 years later, I found out that I had a positive impact on Ron as much as he had a positive impact on me. And then there was this math teacher in juvenile hall who wanted to teach me algebra but couldn't because she didn't have the time or energy because she had 600 other kids during the year that came in and out of her class. And she photocopied an algebra book and said, here, when you get a pencil, because we only got pencils a certain time of day, you can teach yourself algebra. And I did it. And she would photocopy those algebra books three chapters at a time. And, you know, those chapters would come to me and I would do them. And it just built up my self-esteem at the perfect time. And years later when we reconnected, I found out that, you know, that was her first teaching job and that I had a huge impact on her and her teaching career and her life, really, and her faith for the rest of her life. And it's just amazing to me how much kids can give back to adults, too, that are in that situation. And I didn't know it as a kid that I was helping them, too.
The other point that you make repeatedly is that it wasn't an overnight turnaround, that this took time, small steps at a time, and sometimes steps backwards.
Absolutely. I think that's like critical key for anybody to understand, that it's not just overnight, that it's this continual, you know, grace that we need to have for ourselves in making mistakes and being able to forgive ourselves and then to forgive those people around us and not harbor negative feelings, but just keep trying to move forward. And yes, we're going to take steps back. Yes, we're going to be hurt. We're going to hurt others, and we need to have the tools to overcome that. And that's where I think, you know, my education and holding on to that really helped me, and being able to reach out and get counseling and help and then to help others ultimately really helped me to know myself better.
When did you realize that education and that getting an education was A, important, and B, perhaps the ticket out?
Well, my sister had emancipated. My oldest sister had emancipated when she was 15 and gotten out of the house and went on to community college, graduated from high school, went on to community college, was a full Regents scholar at UC Davis for engineering, and became an electrical engineer. And I saw that all happen before I was even 12. I saw that happen, and so I saw that's the way out of this life. I didn't know that I was going to take that path or how I was going to get on that path, but it definitely planted that seed. And then my other sister, you know, my next oldest sister also went on to community college and college at UCLA, and it just opened up my mind that I could do this. And then math was such a great experience for me, just doing math, and it was so therapeutic for me, and it made me stay in school. There's no place else where you could do that much math but school. So I was fortunate in that way that I loved this subject that I could only get in the classroom.
Talk about your relationships with your siblings. You've mentioned a couple of your sisters.
Yeah, I was kind of mothered and cared for by my oldest sister, you know, all the younger siblings, we kind of slept within her bed. You know, she was like the surrogate mom, and she was 15 when she left, and I was 3, and then, you know, she would try to stay in contact with us and pick us up, you know, during her summers off of school or whatever, and have a positive influence on us, and I think she did that really well. She obviously couldn't just parent all of us, but she tried her best, and my other siblings as well, I think, tried to be just positive and loving as much as we would fight, sometimes even physically. But, you know, with my brothers, we were really torn apart when my stepdad came into the picture, and that was difficult because I was close to them as well. And then my baby brother, the youngest one that was just born, he actually came to live with me, and I helped him get into community college, and he graduated from Fresno State with honors and went on to, you know, and he got a business degree, and he's doing well, and I just am so proud of him, almost like, you know, a son. And so I have, you know, we all have mixed relationships with each other, different relationships, but right. I'm fortunate to have them in my life.
Did any of the others wind up on the streets in situations at all analogous to yours?
Similar, just a lot of drugs, and I still have family that unfortunately struggles with that. There's still poverty, a lot of poverty in my family, and just that, you know, survival mode. But that I know of, none of my sisters or anything were actually sexually exploited, just me.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about getting into community college, beginning that journey that took you to Fresno State and UCLA.
Well, I was 12 when I dropped out of school, so I missed 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. Even though I sat and taught myself algebra in juvie, I wasn't really in school. Those are minutes you spend in a classroom in juvie. It's not like school. You're not making progress unless you're self-directing. So, yes, I taught myself algebra when I was supposed to be in 8th grade, but I was really out of school from 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. 10th grade, I went back, and I went to continuation high school. And that's when a teacher there said, guess what? You can also go to community college and take these community college classes, and they will count for your high school degree. And it just opened up this whole world to me of community college that was wonderful. I mean, it was just an atmosphere where I could learn, and socially where it was okay for me to be. I just fit in a lot better than I did in the traditional high school. And so I excelled at community college and ended up getting into all the UCs that I applied to, and being able to go anywhere I wanted. But like you said earlier, the kind of two steps forward, three steps back, I was in this pattern of getting into abusive and bad relationships, and so that held me back a little bit. But I still tried to stay in school as much as I could, and I made it through, went to Fresno State, majored in math, and then taught math for a year and applied to law school.
You got a law degree, an MBA, you wound up in working in private equity. You walked away from that to do what?
Well, I wanted to go back to Fresno and rebuild that community that was so much a part of the torture and the nightmares and the horror that I lived. And when I did a documentary back in 2005, we started the project, but I went back to those streets where I had been sexually exploited, and I found out that kids were still being sexually exploited in the same motels nightly, the same ages as me, 12, 13 years old, and being held in these places by these pimps and traffickers just because they were seeking love and they needed, you know, they were alone and they were being manipulated by these people and exploited, and we were giving them a physical place, a motel, a place, a commerce area where people could buy children, and it bugged me so bad. And I had learned enough in school about venture, about private equity, about funds, that I wanted to go out and start a real estate fund just directed at purchasing and demolishing, really, and rebuilding communities that were experiencing this exploitation, this street prostitution of children. I wanted to rebuild those communities because inside of those communities are people, they're families, there are people that have dreams and hopes just like I did, and they were just being tortured and held down in these neighborhoods. And so I went back to Fresno to go to that street, and I started doing community organizing and organized that community that was around Parkway Drive, Motel Drive, and started getting some traction. And then 2008 happened, and the idea of a fund and getting funding for something like that just went out the door. It was just not possible. And so I had to just adjust one more time in my life, the things that, you know, my goals. And I sat for the bar exam, and I passed the bar on the first try, and I went out and tried some lawyering, and then decided that my path was really about ending sexual exploitation in any way that I can. And so I started working on trainings and doing outreach in communities and writing this book, and that's led me here to where I am today with a company of my own. And it's a for-profit company with a charitable purpose, and it's a flexible purpose corporation, and we offer trainings, and we're able to go out into communities and make a difference.
And where do you want to go from here?
I still have the dream of being able to do the fund where we transform communities. I don't know if it's going to be at first just a social venture fund where we do some investing in businesses within communities to try to transform in a different way. Eventually, yes, I would love to buy that real property and tear down those motels and rebuild something that makes more sense for children and for communities. But I think I'm still a ways away from that.
Carissa Phelps, the book is Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. Carissa, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.